Good morning and welcome to the March 31st edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
We've got a great show coming up this morning. We're going to start by speaking with Mark Dunkelman. He's the author of Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress, and How to Bring It Back.
And then we'll be joined in studio by Eileen Mullane to learn about her newly opened RE Park City in the Prospector area. And we'll finish the hour with Stephanie Padilla and hear about Savannah's unique boutique out in Junction Commons. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Mark Dunkelman is a man who asks a pretty fundamental question. Why is it that America can no longer do big things? Things like creating an amazing railroad system or a vast electrical grid. He gives us his take on the answer in a new book, Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress and How to Bring It Back. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Mark, tell us, what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
Yeah, so this was like a 10-year project for me. It just took forever. And it began because I was living in D.C. and commuting up to New York all the time. And I was taking the train. And while I was taking the train 10 years ago, I was reading a book or rereading a book called The Power Broker, which was this Pulitzer Prize winning book in 1974 about a guy named Robert Moses, who remade New York as it was. He was the most powerful man in New York City from like the 1930s to the 1960s. And he built all the big infrastructure around the city, lots of it. He built the expressways, he built housing projects, he built Lincoln Center, he built the UN headquarters. He did just sort of remade the physical landscape of the city. And I was taking the train up to New York and ending up in Penn Station. And I don't know how many of your listeners will have taken the train to Penn Station. A lot of them, I bet. And Penn Station is and was
a dump.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's just horrible, just a rat's nest. And I was thinking to myself, how is it that Robert Moses, when he was at the peak of his power back in the day, was able to build sort of most famously the Cross Bronx Expressway, which was this expressway that built a cavern through like these vibrant working class neighborhoods in the Bronx and just decimated them. And now here we have the world's second most heavily trafficked transit hub, Penn Station. More people go through Penn Station each day than go through LaGuardia, Newark, and JFK airports combined. How is no one able to redo this train station? And so I didn't have a really good answer to that question. And so I spent years trying to figure it out. Like, what had changed to make it so that it used to be that we couldn't say no to bad projects, and now we can't get good ones off the ground? And that started, 10 years of research that led to this book.
And you know, there's certainly a lot of criticism that can be aimed at Robert Moses, and that Power Broker book is just still, this many years later, an amazing book. But he did get that stuff done, and he managed to overcome lots of obstacles, and no one can seem to do this today. You say that you're addressing this book primarily to progressives. What do you mean by that term?
Well, the issue is that Robert Moses, when he was doing all this stuff, was himself considered a progressive, right? The progressives at the sort of in the middle of the 20th century, their view was, we've got big problems. We don't have sewer systems. We don't have public health systems. We don't have transit systems. We don't have highways. We need some big bureaucracy to do big things. Like, that was the progressive point of view. That's what the New Deal was about. That's what the Great Society was about. And then we woke up in the 60s and 70s, progressives did, and said, whoa, this establishment that we've empowered to do all these things have done also a bunch of terrible things. Like, they've plowed down entire neighborhoods through slum clearance. They got us into the Vietnam War. Turns out a lot of them are bigots who are part of the Jim Crow system. Like, we went through and we sort of saw, like, I'm not so sure about this establishment that we progressives have created. So in reaction to Moses and to the war and to Robert McNamara, to all these sort of old progressive standbys, in reaction to our new hatred for the establishment, we created all sorts of new barriers to getting things done. We created new sorts of checks. We created new veto points in the system. Like, so it was progressivism that created these powerful institutions that could do big things, and then it was progressivism that created all these checks on these big, powerful figures. And so the story of the book is how progressives went from sort of this one vision of trying to empower big institutions to do big things to really spending the last half century saying, we don't want big institutions to be able to make big changes in our lives. We're going to put these checks and these processes in place to check them. And so the story, like the story that I uncovered as a progressive, reading, you know, reading The Power Broker and then commuting through Penn Station, was that this was a problem that we ourselves had created sort of to vex our own original vision of big, powerful government.
And I think you use the term in some places, I think it was vitocracy, which I thought was a wonderful term. You also talked about a frame. You frame it by talking about the differences between conflicting impulses from that are Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian. Let's talk a little bit about what those mean, because I think it was a really useful frame as I was reading the book.
Yeah, so the it's exactly right. That's exactly how I framed the book. And the book begins with the beginning of the progressive movement at the turn of the 20th century. So suddenly, you know, America had been sort of a country of what they call island communities. You know, you lived in one town and like basically everything happened right around you. It was hard to get from one place to another. And then the railroads in the late 19th century, in the late 1800s after the Civil War, really changed everything, because suddenly, you know, whether a railroad hit your town or bypassed it, what the rates were, what the schedule was, like your well-being depended on the people who were all generally on the East Coast making these decisions. And like never before had people felt so subservient to big, powerful institutions way back east, far away from them, where they didn't even know who the people were. It used to be that you could sort of figure out with the local machine boss and the local mayor or the local judge, like that was where the power was. Now it was way far away. And so the question there at the beginning of progressivism was like, how do you fix this problem? Like, how do you counter the power of the big trusts or the big railroads? And there were two ideas about it. One idea, which I call Hamiltonian, was let's create a big institution that can oversee them, that can regulate the railroads or the trusts. And that was sort of TR's vision, Teddy Roosevelt. He wanted to create a big bureau of corporations that would create, you know, regulations that made sure that everything was fair, that that made sure that there was some oversight over the big corporations. But it was to create a big, powerful public bureaucracy to oversee these private institutions. And then there was a second impulse, which was the quote-unquote antitrust impulse, which was to say, we don't want big, powerful bureaucrats or powerful corporations. What we want to do is we want to make everything small again, like it had been in the 19th century. That's the Jeffersonian impulse, sort of like wanting to re-empower the old yeoman farmer who would control things. And so we would use antitrust, and we'd break up the corporations, and we'd break up the trusts, and we would have small businesses be sort of the centerpiece of the American economy. And so in one case, in the Hamiltonian case, we're taking power as it exists and pushing it up into a big public institution, in that case, a federal institution or a state institution, whatever it is, it's pushing power up. In the Jeffersonian, it's to say power is as it is too consolidated. We want to disperse it. We want to push it down to ordinary people. And my argument in the book is that progressives embrace today, like then, both of these impulses simultaneously. When we look at problems like, say, climate change, we think to ourselves, what's the solution to this? It's clearly Hamiltonian. We need to push power up into an institution that will tell the polluters of, you know, people putting out carbon emissions, stop, right? We need a Hamiltonian solution to that. On reproductive rights, by the contrast, our fear is that some powerful institution, some bureaucrat will tell women what to do with their bodies, and we want to return that power back to the individuals, to the women who want to control that for themselves. So these two frames, Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian, exist sort of side by side, or existed sort of in a yin and yang. And the history of progressivism from the very beginning is the movements sometime wanting to be more Hamiltonian and sometime wanting to be more Jeffersonian. And we've gone back and forth through the course of the last 150 years.
And you mentioned TR, and I can't help but ask you about a story that I just found fascinating, which is the story you tell about the 1912 convention and how these conflicting impulses, how people were trying to have it both ways.
Yes. So the 1912 convention is sort of this fascinating piece that I discovered on my own. There's an offhand line about it in a book I'd read, and then I went back to the microfiche and dug up this story. The progressives in the 1912 convention, people will remember this convention. It had three people who eventually are president running at the same time. It's William Howard Taft is the incumbent. He's the Republican. Woodrow Wilson is the Democrat. And Teddy Roosevelt, who had been Taft's predecessor, runs as a third party on the Bull Moose ticket or the Progressive Party ticket. And Roosevelt had wanted to win back the Republican nomination and push Taft off the ticket, but lost. And so he comes back and after losing that nomination, starts a third party. And the third party is meets in Chicago, and it has people who have both this Hamiltonian and this Jeffersonian impulse. The people who have the Hamiltonian impulse, a guy named George Perkins is sort of financing a lot of the convention. His view is that there is too much competition in the American economy, and that that's leading to fraud and abuse. And, you know, he's an old life insurance executive and has seen sort of bad things happen when there is too many life insurance companies. So he wants to create a big, powerful institution that will regulate all these corporations. And but all the sort of the reformers who come from the academic sphere are all so put off by big corporations that what they want to do is do a superpowered Sherman Antitrust Act and push power down to the small businessman and to really go into the teeth of the big corporations. And so there's this fight in the Resolutions Committee in the basement of the hotel the day before the Progressive Party platform is going to be read to the plenary, and there's a fight between Perkins and these other reformers, and the reformers win, and they have a business plank in the platform that goes out the next morning and is printed in all the newspapers and is read to the plenary that says we're going to really go into the teeth of big corporations and try to break them up with a supercharged Sherman Antitrust Act. And Perkins, we know that Perkins went to tell TR about it, and he was sort of complaining about it. And there's reporting that when the platform was read to the plenary, he looked sick and like stormed out of the convention hall. And then we still don't know exactly what happened, but for some reason, 2 or 3 hours later, the communications director of the Progressive Party convention goes to the AP offices in Chicago and says, the business plank that was included in the original version of the Progressive Party platform was included in error. So please strike it. And so in the morning editions of the paper and the evening editions of the paper, this language is cut out entirely. And so, like what happened, then all the reformers start talking to each other, and who is it that's responsible for stealing the plank out of the platform? And they start blaming Perkins, and there's an effort to get him pushed out. Again, so it becomes a sort of hyper drama. Like it probably, not unlike some of the drama that we're seeing today about who's going to be in and who's going to be out of the Trump administration. But there's this sort of major drama. And when TR eventually loses that campaign to Woodrow Wilson, there's a sort of sense that if he had maintained that language, maybe some of those Wilson voters would have stuck with him. And so it becomes this very controversial moment that sort of lost to history in the 1912 presidential election.
Yeah. So the book is filled with examples of how what were originally seen as progressive ideals have resulted in the collateral damage of paralysis. Can you share a bit about the Memphis Freeway project that resulted in the Overton Park Supreme Court decision and contrast that with what Robert Moses did with the Bronx?
Sure. So, the Roosevelt administration, as in Franklin Roosevelt's administration, was the one that really got off the idea that we were going to build a national highway system. And he had this sort of almost crazy idea that the federal government should create a United States Highway Corporation that was going to build the interstates and then finance them by by renting the real estate by the highways. That was sort of his scheme. It didn't work, and it didn't pass until the Eisenhower administration, where Eisenhower, who was a little reticent, along with some very fiscally conservative Democrats, to invest so heavily in the federal government's treasure in building the highway system, agrees to a gas tax. That's how they'll finance the whole thing. And so from the mid-50s, really through the mid-60s, there's this explosion of highway development across the country, and it's really disruptive. Now, at the very beginning, everyone is excited about it. So people really want the highways near them. They want the interstates near them. If there are any protests, the protests are that there won't be an exit close enough to this community or that community. Like people want access to these new freeways with the fear that if they don't have access, they'll be sort of cut off economically. But by the mid-60s, there's this growing fear that these highways are doing really destructive things in cities and even across rural areas. Like so this notion that, you know, you're breaking up farms by shoving a highway across it, and farmers can't get to some of the crops on the other side of the road. And so there's a story actually starts in San Antonio where the senator from Texas, Ralph Yarborough, who's the last liberal to be elected from Texas, is worried that a new highway that's going to go from downtown to the airport north of San Antonio is going to go through their sort of central park, like this beautiful park in the middle of San Antonio. And so he inserts a provision into federal law that says that that engineers, when thinking about where to site highways, need to try to avoid greenery, public greenery, like parks. Not with the notion that like that's going to mandate that they can't touch greenery, but that like they should at least think about it. And like no one really cares at the time because, you know, like the people in Texas are thinking, I don't, you know, like sure, we'll consider other routes and then we'll just discard those other routes because we want to go through the park. So fair enough. So what happens is that a few hundred miles to the north in Memphis, there's a plan to put, I think what it would be, I-40?
I think it's 40.
I-40 through, it's going to go from North Carolina all the way to California and straight across the country. And it's going to connect in Tennessee. It's going to go from Nashville to Memphis and then across the Mississippi River into Arkansas. And in order to do that, the folks in Tennessee want to build a highway through what is called Overton Park, which is Memphis's sort of central park, like the right in the middle of the city. It's got the zoo, it's got the, you know, the public amphitheater, it's got a beautiful park. And the options to build I-40 through Memphis, you're either going to have to go through that park or you're going to have to go north or south of that park and through residential neighborhoods. And so, like, there's no great option. And so the cheapest option, it seems, is to go through the park, because at least then you don't have to take anyone's home, you don't have to take anyone's business. And that's what the engineers decide to do. And a woman there in Memphis, named Nona Stoner, says, this is terrible. Like, this is going to ruin this park. And so she sues. And everyone assumes that she will lose, that, like, the engineers, the establishment, the Robert Moses types who live in Tennessee are the ones who should get to decide and will get to decide. No judge is going to stand in the way of Tennessee's Robert Moses. But what happens is that the case gets appealed and appealed and appealed, and it eventually gets to the Supreme Court. And when it gets to the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall, the sort of lion liberal of the court, writes a decision called Overton Park, which says that even though Congress wrote that it was just sort of an advisory, a demand to consider the routes and the impact on greenery, what they meant, this is the judiciary interpreting law, what they meant was that you cannot go through any greenery unless there is no reasonable and prudent alternative. And this is seen, like, you know, the New York Times writes on the front page that this victory for the anti-highway crowd, the people who are worried about the environmental impacts or the sociological impacts or whatever, that it is equivalent to Gettysburg or to Yorktown, right? Like it's that big of a deal. And what's so remarkable is that that Overton Park decision has which, you know, comes down in 71 or 72, I think, that like that is still the abiding law. Like if you want to build a high-speed rail line today, you basically can't go through public greenery because you can't take right of way that would touch a blade of grass. And you can sort of see the logic there, right? Like as a good progressive, you think to yourself, well, the expressways are terrible and they've destroyed neighborhoods and they've had deleterious effects on, you know, the quality of life, and, you know, there's cars over transit and all sorts of things. And like, there's a point to that. And probably in the way that Robert Moses destroyed the South Bronx with the Cross Bronx Expressway, like this ruling would have, might even have stopped him from doing that to the degree that he went through Parkland. Certainly that maybe not that project, but there are other projects. Like he went through Riverside Park in Manhattan when he didn't need to, and through Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. But the impact today is that you basically can't build new infrastructure if it impacts greenery. And that's one of several new barriers that we've created with good intentions, right? Thurgood Marshall's ruling was created with the best of intentions. And, you know, there's a reason that people celebrated the ruling when it happened. But that, when combined with all these other checks on what government can do, has made it almost impossible to build new rights of way for transportation, even as the country grows.
And this was one of many examples. I thought it was particularly resonant. As we're coming near the end, there are lots of ways in which this Hamiltonian versus Jeffersonian impulse manifests itself today. I think at one point you talk about the sort of, in terms of the building of housing, NIMBYism versus YIMBYism, right, where you have sort of these two conflicting impulses acting itself out in local areas regarding the construction of housing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated one. Of all the examples I have in the book, like that's sort of a complicated question, because the question is, if someone wants to build, say, a fourplex on a lot zoned for a single family home, who should get to decide whether that's permissible or not? Should the person who wants to build, who owns the property, be able to do that as of right? Should the neighborhood, which is going to be affected by the fact that it's now a fourplex rather than a single family home, should that neighborhood get a say? Should the government, in the city or the state or the federal government, should somebody who doesn't live in the neighborhood but is aware of the housing crisis we have in the city or in this country, that there are not enough homes for the people that want them and so prices are rising, should those people get to decide? And like, there are good reasons for all of those people to have some sort of influence, right? You can make an argument for all of them to have some role to play. If you're living in the neighborhood and someone wants to build something that is completely out of character with what you envision for the neighborhood, you bought into the neighborhood 20 years ago for a reason, and now someone's saying, I want to build a kind of housing that was not here before, like, you could understand why someone wouldn't like that. But does that concern, that preserving the character of this neighborhood, override the broad concern that, like, the person who owns the property isn't getting to do the thing that they want to do on the property they own, or the broader societal concern that housing is getting too expensive because nobody wants their neighborhood changed? People in wealthy neighborhoods don't want the riffraff moving in as they see it. People in poor neighborhoods don't want to be gentrified. Like, nobody wants change from what they have now, but like, the country's population is growing and the housing has to go somewhere. So who should get to make that decision?
Exactly. So with all that said, what has to happen in order to actually get things done?
In the end, we have to have a balance of these Hamiltonian Jeffersonian impulses. The Hamiltonian impulse, when Robert Moses was able to plow through the South Bronx without anyone able to say no, that was too Hamiltonian. That was a mistake. It shouldn't have been that the mayor and all the community groups like that Moses could turn a deaf ear to them and destroy this whole vibrant working class corner of the city without anyone being able to say no. Today, we've gone too far to the Jeffersonian end. We've created too many checks so that even when somebody has a good idea, it's just too easy to stop it. And so we need to find some way where everyone has a voice, but no one has a veto. We need to have some way that ultimately someone is responsible for making the decision, for looking at the environmental impacts, for looking at the fiscal impacts, for looking at the neighborhood impacts, for looking at all the different things and saying, look, there's no perfect solution here. There are trade-offs to be had. There are some communities that are going to benefit from this rail line, from this transmission line, from this housing project. Look, whatever it is, someone needs to be empowered to say, yes, we're going to do this, and to be able to do it fairly expeditiously. Like, the problem in many of these cases is that there are so many vetoes and so many hurdles that someone who has an idea has to clear that it takes so long that people just either don't propose anything anymore, or by the time they get the approval to do it, like, the moment has passed and, like, there's no money to do the project anymore. And so we need to be able to create a system where everybody has a voice, nobody has a veto, and decisions are made fairly expeditiously.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mark. So we just spent a few minutes with Mark Dunkelman and his book, Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress, and How to Bring It Back. Thank you again. You enjoy your day, and we'll be right back. Joining us here in studio is Eileen Mullane and Jennifer Reddington, owners of RE Park City. Is it Re Park City or RE?
We like to say Re.
I like Re. Okay, Re Park City, a high-end thrift store with selected items that may not be found elsewhere. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Right on. So did I get the description right? Is it a high-end? I walked in there and the white carpet right away. I took my shoes off.
I felt like I had to take my shoes off. We're premium brands,
yep,
for sure. Trendy handbags and jewelry.
Yeah, and I would say, I'm not sure I would use thrift, but we like to say pre-loved.
Pre-loved, yes.
Recycled.
Upcycled.
Right, the spirit of the name is really a play on reuse, reimagine, and repurpose.
So. Beautiful, beautiful.
So, do you know how many words start with R-E? I looked it up.
I think it was 1,046.
2,000 something.
Very
That's
cool.
That's remarkable.
We're having fun with that wordsmithing with that, for sure.
Okay, let's see how many RE words we can put into this conversation for the next 12 minutes. Okay, so now my daughter's a big thrifter. We're not going to call it a thrift store, but she just is. And I've been to different pre-loved stores. And I can't put my finger on it, but something really makes your store stand out. What do you think it is?
Well, we really tried hard to make the space sort of elegant and beautiful. We wanted to create a space where people were comfortable. We like to think of ourselves as sort of a non-consignment store. We didn't want miles of racks and crowded spaces. We just wanted to give women a nice, comfortable, lovely space where they could easily find things on a rack. We organize things by color to try to facilitate, you know, putting outfits together. So, you know, we were very mindful about, you know, colors and rugs and music. And we just wanted to create a place that was really nice for women.
A couple of nuts and bolts question. How many square feet is the store?
The store is 1,400 square feet.
Okay, so it's
significant.
Yeah, that is a significant space in that neighborhood in particular.
Yes.
And is most of your sort of financial, are you running out, is it a consignment basis, or do you actually buy some of the goods?
Mostly consignment.
Mostly consignment.
I would say we want to move into some lifestyle type mm-hmm. items, and that they would be purchased when we find them at different merchandise marts.
How do you find this stuff?
Yeah.
Well, we have a wonderful town here. I mean,
we do.
This network. You put the word out, and people found us and brought in some beautiful, beautiful things.
So yeah, we started out really with friends and family, and that got the ball rolling, and now we're friends of friends, and now just word of mouth, and as Eileen said, the community has been wonderful, and fortunately, we live in a community of women with beautiful things in their closets.
So. And we've been doing some Instagram, some social media. Mm-hmm. We're growing into that because we have to be adaptive. That's what you have to do.
Yeah, exactly. So I picture you being invited to a dinner party, and then just kind of wandering down the hall into the bedroom, go through their closet, grab a couple things, and we're going to consign these for
you. Well, actually, Jen does a concierge service. So
oh.
We do. That. So we actually, so yes, I dream of doing that. I dream of those closets. But we do offer a concierge service. Again, we want to make it seamless and comfortable for women to be able to consign clothes. So I will come to your house and help you go through things in your closet or pick up or whatever, and for things that if we have customers that just, you know, we if it's not quite right for our store, we'll also facilitate donating it as well.
So my ignorance of fashion is a thing to behold. So and I just sort of wonder, is there a half-life to this stuff? In other words, how long is something viable, even on this high-end level? And well, are you getting some stuff that's old enough that it's come back?
Yes. Well, you've heard the term vintage. So vintage is, boy, anything like 15 years or older. It's kind of called circular fashion now. I wear it, I sell it, the next person. It's fast fashion, which is buy.
Right.
Circular fashion is the term that's used now.
So a lot of people need the latest and greatest, right? And those are the ones that can consign it to you. So it's maybe 2 years old. And
maybe some tags still on some things. That's been known to
happen. Have you got some stuff with tags
on? Oh, yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, yeah, I'm with Roger. I can't tell you if something's this year's or last year's, or I can tell if it's from the 60s or 70s, but that's about as far as I can go.
So how'd you get here? What led you guys to do this?
Well, that's an interesting story. We were kind of serendipitous. Near Thanksgiving, we were talking about, gosh, this town could really use a nice consignment shop because consignment purchasing is definitely on the upswing. And then talking with Jen, I had experience with Right at Home. I had sold Right at Home. Jen has a lot of fashion experience. So we were like, I looked at her, she looked at me, and we said, I think we can do this.
Excellent. And you're next to Billy's haircutter. A lot of people,
yes.
Go over to Billy's. That's fantastic. Let's go into the old store, Right at Home. You told some great stories to me when I popped by over there. So when did you open Right at Home?
Right at Home opened in 2001, right before the Olympics, which sounds like so long ago now, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's been around for 23 years. We like to think of it as an institution in town.
Exactly, and you owned it that entire time, and now it's still there, but you're not the owner.
No, there were three original owners, and we sold it to two sisters that run it now, and that was about 3 years ago. But we're great friends, and they sure send customers down, and we send customers to them, all part of that consignment circuit.
So let's talk about the range of products that you currently sell, and whether you have ambitions to broaden that.
So right now, we, as Eileen mentioned, we're looking for premium brands of women's clothes, jewelry, purses, tote bags. We love those. Hats, belts, those type of accessories. So yeah, we're really just still building and growing. You know, people bring pillows. And we're like, okay, we're completely flexible. So we're very open. We do not right now carry or accept shoes or athleisure wear. So other than that, we're pretty flexible. And in terms of things being current, we love current things and the latest fashion. But you know what? If something is older and it's interesting and it's cute, we accept those too. We really want a broad range of things, and we want interesting things.
So now let's say someone comes to on vacation to ski, and their bag is lost by, you know, whatever airline. You have ski clothing, I think I saw in there. So they can go in and get completely fitted up to go hit the slopes, besides
exactly.
The skis and boots.
Thank you for bringing that up. I forgot to mention that. Absolutely. We have beautiful ski things as well. So, yes. We want to have a broad range of things for people's needs.
And speaking of broad range, I mean, Park City is a reasonably casual town, but
there are increasingly numbers of things where you got to get dressed up. So how formal, how high-end in terms of formality is your inventory at this point, and what are you looking for in that regard?
We have quite a few formal dresses.
Really?
And we're coming into wedding season. Just even this past weekend, we had many shoppers wanting to find a special dress for a wedding in New York or in L.A. So we have quite a wide variety of formal wear.
Mm-hmm. Tuxedos for men, or is it?
No, sorry, guys.
Have you thought about men?
We have thought about men, and we just, and maybe down the road, we're open to it, but yeah, not right now.
Okay, so I won't be visiting again? Is that what you're, unless I have kids for my spouse?
It all depends on what your hobbies are, but that's neither here nor
there.
There
you go.
You have ladies in your life, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
You could come on in.
Absolutely. I know my daughter will be definitely stopping by there. What else can you do you want to share with our listeners to give them a sense of, over the radio, what the store is like?
Well, I'd like to bring up that we really want to engage the community because we have a beautiful, beautiful space. Like, for instance, tomorrow a group is coming in, maybe 10 ladies, to have some coffee and bagels and shop and visit. So we are a community space at the same time as a shopping space.
And there's plenty of parking.
Plenty of parking in the rear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you can park in front.
You can park in front. There's a few spots in front, too.
Yeah. Yes. Excellent. And you have a website?
We do. It's a basic website, but it really, I think, does a good job of conveying our mission and our goals. So, yes,
and
please.
It is?
And www, of course, reparkcityut.com.
Okay.
And early on, you had mentioned you're on Instagram.
Instagram. And we think we're being kind of creative with Instagram and sustainability issues. So that is re_ParkCity.
_ParkCity. And when people bring stuff in, do you take pictures and then that goes up on the Instagram? And then people can, and then you delete it after it's sold?
You know, we're not there yet.
Okay.
So that is
online
that
inventory
is
pretty ambitious.
Yeah, that's
yes.
Ambitious.
Yeah, that's.
So we do highlight some of the great clothes we have, but we, in terms of really building that out, we're still working on that.
Now, what if something doesn't sell? Like it's been there for, I mean, you've been open for a few months, but let's say it sits there for 6 months. Do you then donate it?
Wait, person will either come and pick it up.
Okay.
Or we can donate it on their behalf.
And do you have a standard time limit?
90? We're trying 60.
60.
Might be 90. If an item is particularly special, it might be longer, but we're going with the flow on that one.
Yeah. Roger, any other questions?
Unless there's anything else you guys like to add?
No, we're just very excited and excited for this town.
Yeah, and I just like to thank the community for the goodwill we've received and the support. It's been really moving and wonderful, and I just want to say thank you.
It's an excellent community, no doubt.
Okay, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
We'll be right back after this.
Anyone out there who's had their own grand opening of a business knows how exhausting and exhilarating it can be. Joining us after a 3-day grand opening is Stephanie Padilla of Savannah's Unique Boutique. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Right on. So I think our listeners want to know. I mean, I know I want to know. What is Savannah's Unique Boutique and who is Savannah?
Okay. So contrary to popular belief, I am not Savannah. Savannah is my 14-year-old daughter. So essentially, Savannah's Unique Boutique is a boutique store where we offer, I guess, two different ways of shopping. One, you can purchase items that I've already made and created and designed, or such as jackets, shirts, hats, things of that nature, even I make Bluetooth speaker tumblers. So it's essentially a tumbler, but the bottom is a detachable Bluetooth speaker. And I can customize the design of the outside of it on the spot. Or you can come and be as creative as you want, and you can make your own items. So we have an array of trucker hats, baseball hats, cowboy hats, fedoras that are all the hat bases. And then we offer thousands of different accessories that people can come in and choose what they want, what fits their personality, and I would help them put it together on the spot, and then they can leave with something that is, you know, unique to them and one of a kind. And then we will be offering make your own jackets at some point in the near future. And then Savannah and her friend, who's one of my employees, they have decided that they wanted to add in make your own t-shirt and make your own sweatshirts. So that is kind of their new venture with the business as well. So it's a lot of creativity going on in the store. However, if you're not feeling super creative or you just want to run in and grab something as a gift, there are plenty of items that I've already designed and made.
I'm going to jump back to the tumbler, if that's okay.
Yes, that is exactly what I wanted to do.
It was fascinating. Okay. So it's a tumbler meaning like a to-go?
Like a cup.
Is it like a go cup?
So it's essentially, it's the double wall stainless steel, I guess like a Stanley without a handle, like a Yeti, but not the brand.
So, and does the Bluetooth speak, is it just a speaker, or is it a speaker and microphone, meaning can I grab my coffee, walk my dog, and talk to my coffee cup?
You know. I mean, you could. People might look at you weird.
That's okay. But, they already do.
new here.
So essentially, it's a Bluetooth speaker. So the bottom just twists off if you want to separate it. And so essentially, you could have your speaker, say you're in the hot tub. You could have your speaker outside playing whatever music you want that is attached to any sort of Bluetooth device. Mm-hmm. And then you could have your drink with you inside the hot tub. And it does insulate, so it will keep drinks hot or cold. And I always feel like you're your own walking party when you have one of these, because you can be walking down the street, blasting music, having whatever beverage of your choosing, and it's super fun.
And can we customize the outside of it?
You can.
Okay.
So right now, I'm able to, on the spot, design a layout of a wrap and personalize it, and then I can print it out, and then I have a special machine that will heat press it onto the tumbler, and so people can tell me, you know, I like this show, and then can you put my name on it? Or I had, at one event that I did, I had a grandma who wanted to be called Glamma, and she wanted a tumbler that had her grandchildren's pictures all over it, but it had to say Glamma of Twins. And so I designed something for her, and it's one of a kind, unique to her. And it was a super, super fun, I guess, keepsake for her. But I've also had people wanting to give them as gifts. I had a customer come in yesterday that's looking to have one made for a bridal shower.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, the family reunions, the weddings, all that stuff that starts coming in the summer into the
fall.
So how much will my custom Mountain Money Bluetooth cup cost?
At least two. There'll be at least two of them.
Okay, so one that I've already made is $55. Mm-hmm. I only charge an extra $5 if you want me to design it. And if you start getting super fancy, like wanting me to put like rhinestones all over it or things like that, then maybe talking a little bit extra. But generally speaking, for the Bluetooth speakers, it's just the wrap. Now, I do make another type of tumbler where I create a 3D topper, and those are absolutely crazy. I put collector's pieces on top of them. So say I used to do some cons. And so I would, for instance, take a very popular, say, anime show. And I would design a wrap that would go around the bottom. And then the top, I would just build up a scene, essentially, with either little stones or whatever little pieces, I could build it up, and then I would incorporate collector's items, pins, sometimes the Funko Pops on top, and then I double coat it in food grade resin so you actually can hand wash the entire thing. And it's those were pretty popular at some of those type of events like FanX and things like that. I don't do as much of that anymore because they are extremely time consuming, since literally, like, if it's little crystals, I hand place every single one until I build an entire mountain. So they can take hours and hours and hours, but I felt it was very therapeutic, you know, at the time that I started it. But now Savannah and I are focusing more on our hat bar and jacket bar.
Let's talk about hats. Yeah, let's talk about hats. So you mentioned trucker hats, fedoras, cowboy hats. Let's talk about some of the kinds of things that people are asking you to do for those kinds of hats.
So I literally probably have thousands of different patches. The patches are probably the most popular accessory that people put on. Some people want just one patch. Other people, I had an adorable little girl yesterday who came in and she handed me about 15 patches that she wanted on her hat. They didn't all make sense. They didn't all match. And I see it as a challenge, like a puzzle. So I somehow make it work. And then she also wanted two separate pins added to it as well. And honestly, like, those are my favorites. Mm-hmm. I love when a hat comes together and it looks beautiful, or it looks really like unique and funky. But I love when I have a little one come to me with a bunch of random patches that their parents are giving me the side of, like, I don't know what you're gonna do with this. And then I put it together, and the look on some of these kids' faces when they get their creation, I mean, I've had kids with tears in their eyes that are like, oh, it's everything I wanted. I love it so much. And that makes me really happy.
So your daughter's 14 years old. What kinds of hats are her contemporaries drawn to?
Oh, yeah. 14. That is quite an age.
Yes.
So generally speaking, my daughter and some of her friends are certainly not as flashy as I am. Pretty much everything that I touch in the store is going to either be bedazzled or glittery or something of that nature. My daughter is a little more subdued, definitely into the current fashion trends of the huge baggy sweatpants and the hoodies, and not so flashy. So she actually created her own line because she would tell me, I don't think some of my friends are gonna wear that. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I said, well, what do you think your friends will wear? Because I do very much value her opinion when it comes to her age. Because she does know. She's right in the thick of it, and she knows what they like. She knows what people don't like. So she did end up creating her own line called Sunny Clouds, and their hoodies right now, and it's a logo that she created on the front, and then on the back it's another large spin-off of the logo, and she's got three different colors that have slight changes in the backdrop. But her friends, the people that she knows, seem to want something a little simpler. But then sometimes I have kids that come in that are her age, like yesterday, and they pick out a bunch of glittery things and sparkles. And so it really does vary. I mean, most kids have very different personalities. But I do try to offer something for everybody. I know that if you look at our store and walk in, you will find that it's very bright. It's very funky. But I do have very masculine hats, very masculine patches, as long as you can cross that threshold of the disco balls and things like that. There is something for everyone.
So What would you say, and then what do you think Savannah would say, would be the coolest item in the store?
Well, of course, Savannah's going to say her sweatshirts.
Of course. that was a lay down.
Yeah. I know. So for me, it really is I've been having a lot of fun with the custom jackets right now. I've started to design prints that are specific for Park City as well. But I add my touch to it, which I like to call mountain glam. So I could get some sort of, I'll create some sort of like vintage Park City logo, but then it will either be in rhinestone or it will have rhinestones spread around it. Just something that you don't find at anyone else's store, because a lot of times you can start seeing the same logos, same prints, same hats. So I'm just trying to make mine a little bit different.
And what kind of fabrics are the jackets that you like to customize?
So I am going to start for the customers with jean. I have a bunch of jean bases, but they're all different. So some are jeans that have rhinestones on them. Some are jeans that have fringe on them. I do have a variety of all different kinds, from, you know, faux leather to even, you know, cotton or things like that. Just a lot of different materials. But that is also why I do have people coming to me asking, can I bring you my jacket? Can I bring you my hat? And unfortunately, I have to say no. Because I have spent so many hours testing every single material that I have so that I'm not burning anything. Because right. I would literally lose it if I ruin somebody's hat or jacket or things like that.
Good. Okay, so we just have a couple minutes left. Do you have a website?
My website is now under construction. In fact, I am looking for any high school students that would love to get maybe some volunteer hours, or maybe we could work with the high school on some credits to help put together this website, because I've changed a lot. So my website is under construction at this time, but I do have Instagram and Facebook.
And you are located in the Outlet Mall.
We are now the Junction Commons. Yes.
Okay. Thanks for spending time with us.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.